Welcome back to the Ed Morrissey Show. Joining us, as always, the Prince of Twitter, the Regent of RedState.com, Andrew Malcolm, at AH Malcolm on Twitter when it works. I got up this morning and I got news for you. Your whole realm was down for about an hour.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I guess maybe I wasn't up yet.
Well, that's possible. It's also President's Day today as we're recording this. And I was wondering, maybe X took President's Day off, but they got it working again. So all is well in your realm.
I don't think Musk takes many days off.
I don't think he does either. It's probably the reason why he's worth about $500 billion more than I am at the moment. But
That's okay. Maybe he'll share.
Maybe he will. Lots to share today, though. Lots of stuff still going on, even though it's technically a holiday.
What a great segue. Oh, my God.
I work on these things.
The master of segues.
I work on these things. First off, I guess we should mention this. One of my favorite actors of all time, Robert Duvall, passed away today.
Oh, I know. That was crushing when I saw that.
What a great actor, man. That guy just did everything. He could do anything. He could do comedy. He could do drama. He could do historical period pieces. He was the only thing he couldn't do was be a wartime consigliere, as it turns out. It's the only thing he couldn't do.
And he could have, but for some reason, Michael cut him out.
Yeah. Michael cut him out in Godfather 2 because he was trying to protect them. That's the reason why. There were things that you couldn't be part of. But I mean, he really did. He did it. And he was working until, I mean, his first film role was To Kill a Mockingbird in 1962. He played Boo Radley.
Really?
Against Gregory Peck. Yeah, a very young guy at the time. Well, he was 35. He wasn't that young. Well, 32. He was 32 at the time.
Jeez, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, this is...
What was your favorite role?
You know, I was trying to think of that because I was writing about it for the final word, for tonight's final word. It's the first thing that I got coming up. And there are so many really great roles that he had. I'll tell you the one thing, and this is kind of a funny story about my dad. My dad thinks everything's a comedy. It always has, right?
Yeah.
And so he was telling me this one time about this movie that he saw that starred Robert Duvall. It's called The Great Santini. And he was saying, it's so funny. You got to watch this. It's hilarious. It's such a funny movie. Go watch the movie, and there's a couple of funny sequences in it. There's definitely a couple of funny sequences in it.
I don't want you to think of me as your squadron commander. I want you to think of me as God.
or the chow down thing when he ruined the Navy guy's dress up ballroom thing. I mean that chow down sequence. I still think of that to this day. But I mean, the movie is about this really difficult relationship between a father and a son, and he's sort of this abusive father, and it's actually kind of grim for most of the movie. And,
it's not a happy ending either.
Not a happy ending. Not really a whole lot of happy things happen in it. And I said, Dad, this isn't a comedy. He goes, oh, no, it's funny. It's great. but he was really good in that.
Oh, I have my two favorite Robert Duvall roles are The Great Santini and Lonesome Dove.
Oh, Lonesome Dove is, I mean, I know Larry McMurtry wrote it before Robert Duvall was cast in it, but it's almost like Robert Duvall was meant for that role. I mean, it was so perfect, right?
Perfect casting.
He did a lot of Westerns. He was good. One of the film roles... I liked him as a character actor. He could be a lead actor. He won an Oscar for Tender Mercies as a lead actor, right? But one of the film roles that I really remember him for, it was a film that didn't get a lot of traction. It's called Geronimo, an American American Story or something like that. It's 1993, and Jason Patrick was the lead actor, and Matt Damon was in it. It was based on the real story of how they finally got Geronimo to surrender. Wes Studi played Geronimo. He was fantastic. Wes Studi was fantastic in this. It's really a good movie. It's great. It's really excellent. Great cast. And Gene Hackman was in it. And that brings me to something else that I learned today about Robert Duvall. He played Al Sieber, who was a real life guy, was part of the effort to track down Geronimo. He's a tracker. And Al Sieber was morally ambiguous, and Robert Duvall did a pretty good job of inhabiting that. And I thought it was really, really good role for him. He was in Jack Reacher. I liked him in Jack Reacher. It was sort of a Robert Duvall-ish role, sort of a curmudgeonly kind of guy, you know, owner of a gun range, and who is smarter than Jack Reacher thinks he is. But that was Robert Duvall. He could really inhabit almost any role, and do it well.
Love the smell of napalm in the morning.
Apocalypse Now. Yeah, and he worked with Tom Cruise a couple times. He was the main supporting character in Days of Thunder, and then again he was with Tom Cruise on Jack Reacher, and maybe that was like 30 years apart, right? So, and they worked together really well both times. So the funny story was, I was reading the Wall Street Journal. They had the thing up, their obit on him, and they talked about his early days in Hollywood, where he was hanging out. He was roommates with two guys, one of whom was married, the other was single, and talk about how they were obsessed with sex and how all three of them were struggling actors trying to make it in Hollywood. And nobody would have, and he said, if anybody would have said that the three of us would become as successful as we are, we would have said that they were crazy. Well, the two guys, the other two guys were Dustin Hoffman and Gene Hackman. So they were roommates for a while. Wall Street Journal is talking about how he's telling this funny story about how they were always trying to chase women and all this kind of stuff. Maybe not Hackman so much because he was married, but that he was the worst of the three at it. He tells this funny story about how he tried to pick up these girls, tried to get a date with these girls by telling them about how they had just installed fresh linoleum in the kitchen. It's actually a great story.
I'll read that.
Yeah, it's fun.
Did you see why he died? Just like old age, I guess.
I assume it was his age. You know, maybe he had some sort of, you know.
They didn't say.
I haven't heard. I mean, at 95, I think you just kind of figure that, you know, you finally just sort of run out of gas at some point. But he was working 4 years ago. He had a film come out 4 years ago. So he was working into his 90s, which is pretty good, you know.
He was really good. There seemed to be these airplane crashes and celebrity deaths. I think they come in bunches.
Yeah, you know, I've heard that. But, you know, this is a guy who was, he's a pretty quiet guy. I mean, apart from hanging out with Hoffman and Hackman, who were kind of known for, Hackman especially, kind of known for being a somewhat pugilistic kind of guy in his earlier phases of life. He led a relatively quiet Hollywood life. He didn't really live in Hollywood. He lived on the East Coast. He lived in Virginia, I think, is what it said, for most of his career. But he kept getting work, and he did win an Oscar for Tender Mercies. He was up for another one after that for, I think, Assassination Tango.
And Clint Eastwood is still working.
Clint Eastwood is still working, yeah. Yeah. Well, Dick Van Dyke's still working. Dick Van Dyke turned 100. A few weeks ago.
My first son couldn't say that he couldn't get the idea of three names, so he called him Dick Dyke. And Dick Dyke, and it was Dick Dyke, and my son will always imitate him falling over a living room stool.
Oh yeah. I grew up with that. You know, I grew up watching that show, you know, so falling over or in later seasons, dodging it, right? They redid it so that he actually dodged it. And a couple of the later seasons, just to sort of, you know, swap it around, just to sort of keep people on their toes. He just turned 100 a few weeks ago. And our friend John Andrasik did a short version of of John's beautiful song, 100 Years. It's a beautiful song, and dedicated it to, dedicated that particular performance to Dick Van Dyke and wished him a happy birthday. So,
oh, that's nice.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, it's too bad to see Robert Duvall pass away, but what a 60 years worth of memories that we're going to have with us, you know, forever.
He sleeps with the fishes.
He's Luca Brasi. He has his Luca Brasi moment. All right. Moving on. You got a couple things here that you did last week. I'm trying to think of is there anything that's happening today that we should discuss? I'm trying to think of other than maybe just before we get to it. Did you see Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Tour de Force in Munich this weekend?
I saw part of it and then I was laughing too hard. But wow. I'll tell you what we do need to discuss is Marco Rubio's speech.
Fantastic
speech. Oh my gosh. I posted on Twitter the full text and there's videos available. I think it was 22 minutes. What a masterful speech. Touching all the right bases, being somebody on my Twitter feed said he was Trump tough and Reagan eloquent, and he was. There was a lot of chatter about how he should be the nominee in 28. Of course, it's early, but and even Vance posted a remarkably effusive tweet about how wonderful the Marco's speech was.
I am not surprised. Marco Rubio is incredibly talented. We've talked about this before. I am a little surprised that it was taken as well as it was. And I think this is the Reagan-esque sort of thing about this, because he didn't say anything that was much different than J.D. Vance said a couple of weeks ago. And J.D. Vance, I mean, they almost booed him out of Europe. We're saying basically the same thing. We're not going to manage the decline of the West. That's not what we're here to do. We're here to defend the West and to promote Western civilization and Western values. And Marco Rubio said basically the same thing. I was talking about it with people this morning, and I said, I get the feeling that this is sort of a bad cop, good cop thing that J.D. Vance and Marco Rubio have going on with Europe. J.D. Vance goes out there and says, we're not going to manage the decline of the West. We're here to defend the West. And if you're not with us, then we're going to reevaluate the partnership. And they all go, boo. And then Marco Rubio goes, you know, guys, we love you, but we're not going to manage the decline of the West. And if you're not going to be on board with us, we may have to explore other options. And they're going, well, it's great.
You know, there's a, there are different attitudes you can take.
Yes.
And Rubio takes, to my mind, the smarter, intelligent route, which is you want to get something done, so how can you do it with the least conflict? And some other people just barge in and they, for dramatic effect, they knock over a chandelier or a glass pot and to get everybody's attention. And sometimes that works. It doesn't endear people, but I think the world is used to either a stumbling, idiotic president, U.S., or not boisterous, raucous one like Trump. And Rubio comes in, like you said, the good cop. He comes in and it's quite a contrast. And people are surprised at first and then become pleasantly surprised. And Rubio got a standing ovation.
Well, and again, I think that there's a strategic, there's something strategic going on in that having Vance and Rubio take those two different approaches.
But if you get to the same point, it's okay. You know,
I mean, yeah, absolutely.
There's nothing surreptitious about it, except that you're smart enough to see it. It's, yeah. If we can get Europe to do more on its own, And it takes Rubio to come in and go, you know, guys, we're really with you, but you got to shape up. And I'll tell you what, the prime minister or president of Finland and the head of NATO, those guys are totally on Trump's side. You go on and I forgot the Finnish name, but Rut, the secretary general of NATO. Yep. They explain Trump sometimes better than Trump does. I saw one the other day of Root saying, you know, if you think Europe would have been working towards 5% defense expenditures on GDP without Trump, then you're living in a fantasy land. And he's right. He's right. So they don't necessarily like being pushed. I didn't like being pushed when I was a teenager, but sometimes it's necessary. And the end result is what really matters.
Well, here's the thing about it. And the reason why I sort of emphasize this is, first off, Europe has to work with Trump for the next 3 years. They don't have a choice, right? And after that, assuming that Republicans can hold on to the White House at the end of that, and that's a long shot, I get it, they're going to be faced with either having to deal with Vance or Rubio. And I think that the choice of either Vance, first off, Rubio has already said he won't run if Vance wants to get in the race. So Rubio said that he's not going to run for president if Vance gets in. So to a certain extent, this may already be settled. But I think that if Europe doesn't cooperate with Trump in getting a lot more serious about collective security and getting a lot more serious about defending Western values, then I think what they're worried about is that American voters are going to become even more disaffected with Europe. And they're going to want to send Vance rather than Rubio to deal with them the next time out. So I think that they're seeing that Americans, after, you know, 80 years after the end of World War II, might be a little unhappy about providing a backstop for Europe, for a Europe that is sort of in conflict with the core values. I mean, they're going after free speech. They're imposing all this woke stuff, which, you know, Hillary Clinton got shredded by the Czech deputy prime minister at Munich over this, where she was talking about equal rights for women. And he was basically saying, okay, define a woman. Define what you mean by woman. Because they're kind of sick of this. At least I think Eastern Europe, more than the rest of Europe, is sick of this because they had to put up with Soviet speech controls for 40 years.
Good point. Yeah.
And they recognize it. They recognize the issue. So, I think it's interesting. If that's what's going on, it's a smart move. A little bit of carrot and stick, or good cop, bad cop, however you want to characterize it. But I think it's a realistic way of telling Europe, we might be at a point here where the American people just aren't going to fund this anymore unless they see a whole lot less daylight between the values in the United States and in Europe. And I think that that's it's a legit warning. Yeah,
in some ways it might be too late, but I mean, not from the U.S. point of view, but from Europe's point of view. I don't know how you get rid of several million Muslims or control them.
I want to ask you about something else anyway, before we get to your column.
Ask me about the column. Yeah.
Well, I do want to ask you about the column, but really quickly, the Nancy Guthrie disappearance in Tucson. It's a terrible story. Horrible for Savannah Guthrie, horrible for her whole family. As we're talking about this, and the reason why I remember to bring it up is that there's this news flash that the sheriff has ruled out this being a family related disappearance, right? They finally did this after a couple of weeks, because a lot of people have been just engaging in gross speculation about this. And this is what I want to talk about. When you have an ongoing situation like a kidnapping, do we really need to have a bunch of analysis as to what might be happening behind the scenes? Is that the time for speculation? Because in my mind, you have people talking about Savannah Guthrie is lying. You know, this appeal to the kidnappers makes no sense. She knows who it is. And it's like, A, you have no idea whether that's true or not. Yeah. And B, what does it matter? The point is that her mother's missing and we need to find her mother. You know, all this other stuff we can talk about once the mother's back home, preferably safe and sound. And I just find this really despicable. I mean, all this conspiracy theorizing, all this, you know, so-called analysis is just nothing but speculation about Savannah Guthrie being involved and all this kind of stuff. It's just gross. And look, I mean, I've criticized Savannah Guthrie plenty of times. But I mean, also, it's her mom, and she's a human being, right? I mean, maybe give her a little space.
Yeah, you're right. You know, I come back to a familiar theme in my life, which is a significant part of my childhood was before television. And television, and now its cousin, online and videos, they completely changed, I don't know what you want to call it, the village square. And it allows, it actually encourages, people want to get attention, so they come out with some outrageous thing. So-and-so was somebody's lover, and there's all this, and it gets attention, it gets clicks, and that wasn't a metric before television. Now, there's nothing we can do about it, but I think people need to be aware of how television has changed our life so fundamentally. It's clear after the 1960 presidential debate with Nixon and Kennedy, it changed politics forever. It also made appearance much more important. You know, before there was a television debate, it didn't matter if the one candidate looked unshaven, but suddenly it did because it was visible on television. Nixon had shunned makeup, and so his 5 o'clock shadow was showing. Those kinds of things, they don't matter. They simply do not matter. And if somebody is stupid, like Kamala Harris, that comes across. But in other places, there's an instant judgment based on one comment that in the past could have been corrected if we didn't have television or instant communications. And I'm not bemoaning it. I enjoy television, maybe, well, for sports more than anybody. But I think we need to be much more aware of, well, not being intentionally played, but the existence of television changes everything. Politics, entertainment, and these sorts of stories. You know, there were kidnapping stories when I was a kid, and it was like Bonnie and Clyde, you know, oh, they might be in Kansas now. And then we have the shooting in New York City a couple of years ago, and that Mangione?
Luigi Mangione, yeah.
Yeah, and we have video of it, and what was it, 2 days later, they catch him because some clerk at Arby's recognized his face, even with a mask on. So anyway, I think we need to think about these things. When you see something on television or online, you think, how has it, why is it there? And maybe it's there because of television, not because of any validity that it contains. That's all.
Well, go ahead.
No, that's okay. I was going to change the subject because...
No, go ahead and change the subject,
The column, this is... I'm pleased, obviously, but this column has been the most read column I've done for Red State. I mean, the readership is just through the roof. So I hope people will, this is about the cleaning out of Congress, which I don't think many people realize. We're always talking about term limits, but the fact is that Congress people are term limiting themselves in record numbers this year. So
why do you suppose that is? Why do you suppose that is? It's more than usual. Yeah, it's more than usual.
There's always some people coming and going. But there's 9 senators leaving, and I think 4 of them are leaving to run for governor, which makes sense because senators, I mean, let's be honest, they really don't do a whole lot. Governors do stuff. And right. Marsha Blackburn in Tennessee and Michael Bennett in Colorado. And
there's Amy Klobuchar in Minnesota? Amy Klobuchar in Minnesota?
Yeah, Klobuchar in Minnesota. And there's one other one that are quitting to run for governor. And I think they probably have a good chance of winning. They're executives, and chief executives like to get things done. Senators like to talk things, and they're really up on arcane rules, and it's important to them, but it's not very satisfying. And especially when a president has marginalized to the extent he can the involvement with Congress. They seem to have gone along with it. And when I get back to television, television has changed things. And so I asked in the column, who's your congressman? I suspect a lot of people don't know. Senators, maybe they do know. But the only time you see them is when they're walking down the hall in Congress, or they're standing in a gaggle of useless people behind Mitch McConnell or somebody at a press availability, or somebody sticks a tape recorder in their faces that are walking down the hall trying to get to their office. So you don't know, excuse me, we don't know much about what they're doing. And I think in many cases, that's great with them, because I don't think it's much. I don't know how you can go to Congress and you end up like Nancy Pelosi, getting paid $174,000 a year. When she was speaker, it was $220,000, and she's a multimillionaire. So there's some funny business going on. And I think it's great that, well, as of the moment, and it's still early, 63 people who are in Congress now, which is more than 10%, won't be there in the next Congress. And there will be more leaving. There will be some losing. There's a downside to that, and that is you get a lot of new blood, which is great. Fresh blood, younger blood. Some of these people are in their 80s leaving. There's I think the largest number ever. I have it in the column of people of Congress are over 80. They like the perks. They like hanging on. I guess it's a good job to them, but they don't get a whole lot done. And remember, Trump ran against not Democrats. He ran against the establishment in the swamp of both political parties, mainly Congress. And so they're at almost, I think, 14% approval. The lowest ever is 9%. So they're getting close. yeah. And the newcomers come in. It is fresh blood. Hopefully they have new ideas. Hopefully they're a little bit smarter. But they also know less. And the people that do not have term limits and are not leaving are the professional lobbyists who are paid highly to be helpful resources available at any time to feed these guys, these new guys, information that they don't have, that of course is helpful to the cause of the lobbyists. So it's a big deal, this changeover. I'm really pleased that so many people are reading it.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that they're reading it as well. And look, I mean, I think it's one of the things that you have to keeping an eye on is turnover in midterm elections.
Yeah.
Where they're leaving. And some of this is people who have already left. Marjorie Taylor Greene has already left, but that district is pretty solidly Republican. You know, there's a I don't know if you have you seen this thing with the Democrat in Florida that allegedly has been charged with embezzling like $5 million from COVID related COVID-related aid programs and funneled it into her first congressional campaign. That district is pretty Democrat anyway, so even if she has to resign, it's probably going to go to a Democrat. So some of these things, you're going to get new people, but not necessarily a big risk of turnover. But with the House so narrowly split, and just the normal midterm thing,
Well, remember Obama's in 2010, Obama lost 63 seats. It was the worst since the 1930s. And that's huge. It's also huge. There will be another couple more House elections, but that was huge in 2010 because it set up Republican control for the 2010 census reapportionment.
Yep.
And Democrats still haven't recovered from that. I won't bore everybody with the details, but in 2010, besides the 63 House people and a few senators, Democrats lost about 1,000 seats in the state legislatures all across the country. And they've not recovered. I think they're up to 500 getting them back now. But that was a disaster. Of course, Obama could care less about anybody that wasn't him, but it set the tone for Republican, more Republican control that people don't really pay that much attention to. So it is important. Everybody says, oh, this election is the most important in history, but this time it is.
Yep. This time, I think you're right. I think it's going to be very important. It's certainly going to be critical for Donald Trump's strategy. Yeah. So, yeah.
And we'll get some more impeachment attempts if Democrats get the House.
Yep. You'll get nothing but impeachment after that. There'll be impeachment central. All right. So go read Andrew's fine column on this at redstate.com. It's behind the paywall, but hey, you're getting this for free. So go over there and pay for VIP or pay for VIP gold. And then you get everybody or VIP platinum and you get everybody plus some great discounts at our swag store and stuff like that. So that's my quick pitch to set up the jokes of the week. And Andrew has a couple jokes for us today. I've got a couple as well.
I do. The headline starts, Believe It. That's the one on the Congress.
Yes, I'll read it off. Hang on for a second. I scroll to the top because I was at the bottom. Believe it, a historic House cleaning of Congress is coming this fall. Already 10% of it's on its way out. 12%.
Well, these are old as usual. One is a Leno replay. He says Al Gore blamed the unusual winter storms and all the snow and cold on global warming, upsetting the natural balance of nature. Then Tipper said, Al, just pay the kid for shoveling the walk.
Yeah, that's still good, though. That's still good.
Yeah, it is. It is. It is. Finally, Leno, Jay Leno, this old one again, obviously. He says, tonight's our last show after 22 years. So much has happened in that time. You know, the saddest part is, OJ never found the real killers.
I have to say,
have you
seen the new Naked Gun movie, the remake or kind of remake with Liam Neeson? There's a very funny moment about OJ Simpson in that film. And I was not expecting it. And
I think I know what it is. Yeah, that is funny.
They did not hold back. I give them huge, you know, huge cojones credits for doing that bit. And I like the film anyway. The whole film is fun. You got to watch it all the way through the credits, by the way, because there's stuff in the credits that's equally fun. All right. I've got two for you. One of which is particularly speaks to our moment here. But before we get to that one, I'll do this one. So a travel agent looks up to his desk and sees this older man and woman come through the door. Looking at the posters of all the glamorous destinations and they're both kind of looking a little dejected, realizing maybe that they can't afford it. And the travel agent figures, I'm going to do something really nice. So he calls them over to the desk. He says, look, I know that you guys are probably on pensions or limited funds, and you probably can't have a holiday. So I want to send the two of you to a fabulous resort at my expense, and I won't take no for an answer. So he immediately books them the flights, gets their information, books them the flights and the resort, and sends them on their way, and comes back about a month later. And the woman comes back into the shop and he says, well, it's great to see you again. And he says, did you like your holiday? And she's, oh, the flight was so exciting and the room was lovely. I came here to thank you, but one thing's puzzled me. Who was that old fart I had to share the room with? All right. One,
I knew something was up, but I didn't know what that one was. That's great.
All right. That's well, here's the final one, and this is the one that speaks to our moment. A mariner suffers this huge shipwreck in a storm, barely makes it to an island, right? Gets on the island. It's a deserted island. There's no rescue. He's there. He's there for a couple of years. And one morning, he sees a ship going by, and he waves at it, and they stop. And a smaller craft starts coming towards them. So the boat comes up on the beach. And the guy is just thrilled. Oh, thank you. Thank you. And the officer says, wait a minute. He says, I need to show you something. And he waves at one of the sailors, and a sailor comes up with a big stack of newspapers. He says, I need you to read through these and determine whether you really want to be rescued. Maybe
it's
not.
It's very thoughtful. Very thoughtful.
Maybe not.
Maybe not so bad. Not
maybe
so bad.
Maybe you're in a good place. I don't know. Maybe you're in a good place. All right. On that note, we will always be here. This is not a deserted island. We will always be here every week. And Andrew Malcolm, of course, the prince of Twitter, the regent of redstate.com at AH Malcolm on the Twitter Zizzes, and right here at the Ed Morrissey Show. So. At redstate.com. Yeah.
Long time partners
since 2009. So, you know, we're 17 years.
And we're going to do it till we get it right.
Yeah. We're practicing, folks. Eventually we're going to nail this sucker.
We'll have a good show.
All right, Andrew, we'll talk again next week, sir.
Okay. Thanks, Ed. Bye, everybody.